our disposal. So in this conversation, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam responds and says, whenever Allah gives a blessing to someone who knows that that blessing is from Allah, Allah will write on that someone's name the gratefulness to that blessing even before they praise the Almighty Allah. What a beautiful description of the compassionate and kind and merciful and loving Almighty Allah. Here, the first step is to realize that the blessings that we have are blessings from the Almighty Allah. And if we truly believe and we realize and we comprehend with our mind and our heart and our soul that these blessings that we have are from the Almighty Allah, then Allah will write for us that we have been grateful for that blessing that we have acknowledged is from Allah. And not only that, this will be done even before we physically or verbally praise the Almighty Allah for that blessing that we have realized is from Him. So profound, so beautiful, this amazing description of just one of the attributes of the Almighty Allah. If only we go ahead and put forth an effort to truly appreciate all the blessings that the Almighty Allah has given us, then not only will we feel a sense of fulfillment and satisfaction and contentment, but the Almighty Allah, even before we praise Him, because of course the natural consequence of realizing that the blessing is from the Almighty Allah is to praise the Almighty Allah. But even before we praise Him, the beneficent, the merciful, the compassionate, the kind, the most quick to forgive, and the loving, nurturing Lord, the Creator, will write for us that we are grateful. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Jawad, alayhi salam.
And now we invite you to listen to Shaykh Winay Keita about Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam.
Imam al-Jawad salawatullahi wa salamuhu alayhi is an interesting case study for many, many different subjects. The questions that were raised about his imamat relate to questions surrounding his isma, questions surrounding his knowledge, questions surrounding his imamat, questions surrounding his authority. And unfortunately, of course, within the community, this imam is madhlum. He is, of course, madhlum. If we were to ask many people when he went to Kadhimiyya for ziyarah, who is the other imam, there's often a pause. Why? It's often a like, the ninth imam. What's his name? Even half the people I meet, maybe three quarters, don't even remember the name of the imam. Unfortunately, this is a musibah of Ahlul Bayt. There were the musibah of Ahlul Bayt, and we are at times the zalim who are doing dhulm to them through this. Because we remember, this is a very important hadith, that the a'imma were asked, is there any distinction between obedience to Ali ibn Abi Talib and to Imam Rida, for example? He says, no. There is no distinction to be made in terms of wilaya, in terms of obedience, in terms of love, and in terms of commitment between the ninth imam and the first imam, both whose birthdays are in the same week. Yet if we were to come on Friday, we'd probably see 15 times the audience. Is this not a kind of dhulm to the imam of our time? Isn't it? Shouldn't some of us be ashamed of ourselves? Is this something based on the deen, based on the ahadith of a'imma that have said that give more precedence to Ali ibn Abi Talib's birthday than the birthday of my grandson, Imam al-Jawad? No. It is cultural, of course. And of course, Amirul Mu'mineen has his own status. There's no doubt about that. But at the end of the day, for us, they're all ma'asumeen. And obedience to them is equal. A hadith of Imam al-Jawad and a hadith of Imam Amirul Mu'mineen, Ali ibn Abi Talib, salawatullahi wa salamu alayhim ajma'een, in terms of aqidah, in terms of sharia, in terms of akhlaq, in terms of every single subject, there is no tamiz or tafsir to be done, or distinction between the two.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/EN Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many other great programs as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Aruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
It was his sixth hunger strike and the longest, which lasted for 87 consecutive days. Palestinian prisoner Sheikh Khadr Adnan stubbornly resisted until his last breath, asking for his release he always obtained after every hunger strike against his illegal administrative detention by the Israeli authorities. This time, however, his hunger strike ended with his martyrdom in a cold cell in the Israeli prison of Ramli at dawn on Tuesday. Here in his hometown, Arabi, near the occupied Jenin, his wife spoke to the crowd who gathered outside their home to consolidate the family and his nine children. They called for his revenge and also for all Palestinian prisoners languishing in Israeli jails.
I congratulate myself and my children for the martyrdom of Sheikh Khader. Now, after his death and all the sacrifices he made, we do not want a drop of his blood to be spilled. We will not wait for anyone to avenge my husband. His nine children will keep his cause alive. And to the Israeli occupation I say, remember the faces of my children well. By God, we have raised them with pride and dignity.
A general strike has been announced across the occupied West Bank in mourning for Sheikh Khadr Adnan. Protests have been held in several areas, including Ramallah. Palestinian resistance groups have mourned what they described as the execution of the senior leader of the Islamic Jihad resistance movement, Khadr Adnan. They say they hold the Israeli occupying regime fully responsible for Adnan's murder. Since 2004, Adnan had gone on six hunger strikes, drawing local and international attention. Not only did he become a spokesperson for the Islamic Jihad, but also a symbol for the cause of Palestinian prisoners.
The Israeli regime has sent a clear message to the whole world that we will continue killing Palestinians even after their imprisonment. Today, Sheikh Khadr Adnan has set a new level full of pride in the history of Palestinian prisoner movement. After his assassination, the Palestinian people are facing a new stage of struggle. Today, we all must unite and stand against the practices of the Israeli regime for the sake of our prisoners.
All Palestine is sad for the martyrdom of the hero prisoner Sheikh Khadr Adnan. It was not his first hunger strike. Every time he was courageously declaring a hunger strike to reject the illegal administrative detention that the occupation's regime uses to keep thousands of our people behind bars. Unfortunately, this time his strike came to an end with his martyrdom.
Meanwhile, several protests have been held in the occupied Ramallah in response to the Israeli murder of Sheikh Khadr Adnan. The demonstrations turned violent in a number of areas, namely the cities of Ar-Ram, Al-Khalil, and Ramallah, with clashes erupting between Israeli soldiers and Palestinian protesters. Israeli forces fired at the crowds, and a number of Palestinians were wounded. The Day of Rage will always be remembered as a day of honor and loyalty to Sheikh Khadr Adnan, who is considered by many here as a national hero. Every time Sheikh Khadr Adnan engaged in a hunger strike, he insisted that he will not end his action without achieving victory. His definition of victory was either getting released or being martyred. This time he achieved victory by martyrdom. Palestinians also believe he was an iconic figure who succeeded in bringing another defeat to the Israeli regime. Mona Qandil, Occupy Ramallah.
Against the backdrop of that all-familiar soundtrack and amid heavy police presence, pro-Palestinian protesters outside the Leicester branch of the notorious Israeli arms maker Elbit Systems. A short walk into the woods from the demo, members of the Palestine Action Group, donning the iconic Palestinian keffiyeh with one purpose in mind.
I'd like to see Elbit out of the UK. I'd like to see Elbit shut down once and for all in the whole world. But obviously, you know, where we are and what we can do is get Elbit out of the UK. And ultimately, that's what I'd like to see. I'd like to see Elbit Systems completely gone from UK soil.
Beyond the steel fence and barbed wire, Elbit's UAV tactical systems manufactures drones on UK soil. Drones allegedly tested on the captive population of Gaza.
And I was there in Gaza for 2 years. I saw what those weapons do, and they are knowingly making them, selling them. In fact, they are even marketing them based on how much horror they have committed across Palestine and still ongoing.
Members of Palestine Action and other Palestinian supporters have come here today saying they're having to take direct action against Elbit Systems because lobbying the British government through normal channels is futile. And they're calling on people around the world to join their campaign to put an end to Israel's international arms trade.
Elbit, Israel's largest weapons maker, used to host 10 sites across Britain. 18 months of protests and blockades by Palestine Action forced its site in Oldham, Greater Manchester, shut last year.
And it's time. It's time that Israel finally got brought to justice. We've seen enough horror, murder, oppression, occupation, ethnic cleansing. Enough. We've had enough.
The last time Palestine Action tried to close Elbit's Leicester site was 2 years ago. This time, they say, they won't leave until they have finished the job. Saeed Pariza, London.
It has become a well-trodden political path. Press TV being attacked in the British Parliament. This time the mouthpiece was the vice chair of the Conservatives' Friends of Israel.
A shocking report into the online activities of Press TV, particularly their use of a video series called Palestine Declassified, which focuses its hatred on British Jews. Whilst Press TV may be banned from our airways, this foreign state hate operation is continuing online. Can we have a debate at some point on what more we can do to ensure that social media platforms tackle this outrageous content?
In the decade and a half since it was established, Press TV has found itself front and center of Western media attacks. But despite the pressure, the channel continues to advocate for the voiceless, chief amongst them, the Palestinians. The show at the heart of the latest onslaught is Palestine Declassified. Its host, former Labour MP Chris Williamson, gave his take on why the show was such a bone of contention for the pro-Israel lobby.
What we've seen here is a shameless attempt by the Israel lobby in the House of Parliament to whitewash Israel's criminality and lawlessness. And of course, they're very concerned about the fact that Palestine Declassified is shining a light into the murky corners of Israel's activities and indeed on the lobby that seeks to avoid any criticism of their suppression of the Palestinian people. Palestine Declassified is, you know, very effective. It scrupulously researches all of the content that we put out. And obviously, you know, they're embarrassed by the truth that we are bringing to a wider public. And of course, you know, the traction that Palestine Declassified is now picking up it's been suggested, reaching well over 11 million people now. So they're doing their damnedest now, it seems to me, to try and close down our success.
Chris has written a stern letter rebuking some of the smears parroted by Andrew Percy.
There's no truth whatsoever to the allegations that you made. I mean, they suggested that, you know, we sort of are a vehicle for hatred towards British Jews. I mean, the programme is doesn't sort of promote hate in any respect, or it suggested anyway, that he should consider apologising for maligning me and for impugning the reputation of Palestine Declassified and Press TV.
As Palestinians continue to live under an oppressive regime, Press TV's fight to advocate for justice will see it targeted as part of Israel's campaign to close down anyone who stands up for the Palestinian cause, a move branded media terrorism. Amina Taylor, London.
The members of the Pakistani parliament are insisting the coalition government to eliminate obstacles in starting the oil trade with neighboring Iran to overcome the country's energy deficiency. MPs' voices were heard during the recent meetings of the parliamentary committees, in which lawmakers stressed upon the government officials to robust diplomacy for aggressively pursuing options to secure waivers on the oil trade with Iran.
We get 1 million liters of diesel from Iran every day. It's called so-called smuggling. And it's, I think, 50 rupees per liter as compared to here. We should open this up. The region has to open up.
The lawmakers recommended that all-out efforts should be made to secure waivers from sanctions on oil trade with Iran.
I've been saying to the government also that we should open up these borders. Because, like, for the first time, Iran-Afghanistan trade is more than Pakistan-Afghanistan trade. And I think if they can have it, and it's benefiting both countries, so this trade would be very good for us also.
According to the data provided by Pakistan's Commerce Ministry to the Parliament, Pakistan's trade with Iran has crossed over $2 billion, covering food, medicines, cotton, and pharmaceutical products.
This is a huge project. We are engaged in talks with Pakistani authorities over this issue, and both countries will manage to come up with a positive solution very soon.
Like the rest of the world, Pakistan is no exception to the global energy crisis, which is worsening with each passing day. Experts say Islamabad plans to buy oil and gas from Iran, but wants to do in such a way that it escapes sanctions from the U.S. and other Western countries. Although the bilateral trade between Iran and Pakistan has now reached over $2 billion, however, both sides believe that more efforts should be made to strengthen the trade relations further and to support the business community of the two countries. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Turkish Defense Minister Hulusi Akar said there are positive signs that Turkey and Syria could be close to reaching an agreement that would facilitate the return of 3.6 million Syrian refugees to home. Akar talked about the meeting that took place in Moscow between him and Syrian Defense Minister Ali Mahmoud Abbas, with the participation of Iranian and Russian counterparts. The Turkish minister said things will not be solved in one meeting after 11 years of strained relations. However, he says both sides are aware that through dialogue they can find common ground.
We got together with the Syrian defense minister for the first time in 11 years. It was an important meeting. Dialogue is the key. Both sides acknowledge this. It is, of course, not possible to resolve everything at once. Naturally, the parties may have maximalist demands, but we are trying to turn those demands into reasonable ones.
Damascus says its main demand is for Turkish troops to leave the Syrian territory, with officials repeating in every meeting that the road to normalization can only be paved by the withdrawal of thousands of Turkish troops from the Arab country. This point was again raised in last week's meeting and stressed by the Syrian Foreign Minister Faisal Miqdad. He said it is impossible to talk about normalization as the Turkish army continues to occupy Syria's northern areas. But Turkey says its presence in Syria is aimed at fighting terrorism and creating a safe environment for the Syrian people, as well as protecting shared borders, which is Turkey's main concern. Turkey is also worried from a new round of clashes, which could lead to a new wave of refugees.
Both sides have their demands. The Turkish side wants security guarantees. They don't want to see any type of autonomous structure in the northeast of Syria that is led by the YPG group. This is a major security concern for Turkey. And Turkey also has almost 4 million Syrian refugees that it would like to slowly see repatriated in the future. We're still far apart on the demands from both sides for normalization. But this doesn't mean that both sides can't come together on a transactional basis to try to further issues that are of mutual interest.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has hoped that he can reach an agreement with Syria before the upcoming presidential and parliamentary election. Sending refugees back is one of the Turkish people's main concerns, and opposition parties are playing the card of Syrian refugees against Erdogan in their campaigns. A normalization of relations between Ankara and Damascus will definitely ease the pressure on Turkey, whether regarding the refugee crisis or armed groups operating in Syria that Turkey sees as terrorists. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Iran has successfully tested a homegrown plane engine and its control system. The engine was built by experts of Mapna Industrial Group using the reverse engineering method. The testing process was observed by Iran's president, Ebrahim Raisi, who was visiting the company on the occasion of the International Workers' Day. Raisi visited an exhibition on Mapna Group's technological achievements in the fields of thermal and renewable energy power plants, oil and gas, rail transportation, air engines, electric cars, and so forth. During his visit, the Iranian president praised the company, saying he is proud of the efforts made by skilled workers and experts of Mapna.
We must be proud of this level of work, endeavor, creativity, innovation, skill, knowledge, and technology. Truly, this company is one of the industrial groups that have made us proud. It has also made our country more powerful. They have accomplished a lot, and they have lots of important projects that will be completed in the future.
Raisi described the achievements as significant, saying the company's productions are quality enough to be sold on regional and global markets. In 2022, the Mapna Group won an award for being one of the top three Iranian exporters of the year. In July, the company's technology and engineering exports topped 2.5 billion euros.
The major achievements of the Mapna Industrial Group have once again proved that sanctions cannot hinder Iran's development. Iranians have time and again shown that where there is a will, there is a way. Mahdi Abbasian, Tehran.
Paris was on fire for May Day, International Workers' Day, once again. Hundreds were arrested, hundreds were hurt, and tear gas was a constant for hours. The demonstration route was littered with broken glass and fires after cops repeatedly intervened in the march. Protesters targeted banks, insurance vendors, real estate agencies, and sexist advertising, and then the end of the march turned into a multi-hour battle royale.
Tear gas is sadly typical of how our government deals with political demonstrations. French democracy has been tarnished worldwide and appears ridiculous, as it's clearly not based on representative democracy.
Over 2 million people marched nationwide as unions declared May Day the 13th major day of protest this year against a 2-year hike to the pension age, which was rammed into law by executive decree last month. The undemocratic proclamation of the law, combined with the shocking police brutality, had many French people questioning their country's democratic bona fides.
France allows for demonstrations, but the problem is that police don't allow it. We saw that with the yellow vests, and we have seen it again from the very start of the pension protests this year.
Macron has to stop showing such contempt for the people. As a yellow vest, I promise that we will never stop fighting for a real democracy. We want referendums and public participation, while Macron only has fear for the people.
International Workers' Day began in Chicago in 1886 with the fight for an 8-hour workday. It wouldn't be implemented in the West until after their political and financial elites forced World War I, which was largely an effort to maintain monarchical privileges and to forestall socialist-inspired reforms.
Protesters insist they can apply enough pressure on the president to get the unpopular law revoked, something protests also forced in 2006. Press TV's cameraman was hit by a tear gas grenade fired by police seconds before the start of a live interview from the demonstration. It appears like a clear case of police targeting media, as tear gas is normally shot high into the air. The cameraman was not badly hurt, as the projectile only exploded after it ricocheted off his leg. Rami Mazahari, Paris.
It goes under the technical name of European Stability Mechanism, or ESM. It is the Eurozone bailout fund designed to help euro area countries in severe financial distress. The first ESM version was devised in 2012 following Greece's default on its own bonds, which brought the Eurozone at risk of breaking apart with economic instability spreading across the old continent. As Europe faces several challenges to stay afloat, the European Union must devise mechanisms to balance its member states economically. The European Stability Mechanism is a rescue fund for EU member countries that have lost or risk losing market access. In practical terms, it grants conditional financial assistance to states that are on the verge of bankruptcy to mitigate the contagion risks in the bloc.
We, of course, need to remain vigilant. Economic uncertainty remains high and we face numerous headwinds. Events in the US support the EU's choice to apply the Basel prudential standards to all our banks, not just the largest one.
In early 2021, the European Commission and all members of the bloc signed a new agreement amending the previous ESM in a way that it prevents small crises from escalating. On Friday, European Economy Commissioner Paolo Gentiloni called on Rome to stop dragging its heels over ratification of the reform. As of today, all EU member countries have ratified the reform, except Italy.
By holding out on ratifying the reform, Italy is maybe attempting to fetch a better deal on the upcoming reform of the EU's set of fiscal rules. Some are even suggesting that parties in Italy's ruling coalition are caught in some sort of political skirmishes over this issue.
On several occasions, Italy's Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni has criticized the ESM reform, arguing that the bailout funds should be used also as a vehicle for growth. Some time ago, the leader of one of the right-leaning coalition government's parties, the League's Matteo Salvini, said that approving the ESM changes would mean the ruining of lives for millions of Italians and the end of Italy's national sovereignty on budget issues.
Creating wealth to tackle poverty is our top priority, as Italy has already sold many of its strategic assets and made a huge amount of debt. We must focus on investing now.
While Brussels is urging Italy's approval of the European Stability Mechanism, the examination of the bills for its ratification has been at a standstill in the Italian Parliament for almost a month. Max Civili, Rome.
Thank you.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
The Treasury Department warned Congress on Monday that the deadline to raise the U.S. debt ceiling is rapidly approaching. President Biden invited House Speaker Kevin McCarthy and other congressional leaders to the White House next week to discuss the debt ceiling. As Washington scrambled on Monday, 1st of May, to respond to news that the government could default on its debt obligations as soon as 1st of June. President Biden's request for talks followed a jarring new projection from the Treasury Department that the government could run out of cash to pay its bills in as few as 4 weeks without additional borrowing authority. An unprecedented event that could rattle world financial markets and tip the fragile U.S. economy into another recession. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster CNN cable news network has covered this story. President Joe Biden on Monday, 1st of May, called the top four congressional leaders, including House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, to discuss raising the debt ceiling at the White House later this month, following months of an impasse between the president and the House Republicans. President Biden's call came after Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen notified lawmakers on Monday that the U.S. could default on its debt obligations by 1st of June. Biden told congressional leaders, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, and House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy, that he wants to discuss on 9th of May the need to pass a clean bill to raise the debt ceiling. The president's formal call for a meeting follows a month-long standoff between Biden and the Republicans over the debt ceiling issue. Biden has not met with Kevin McCarthy since February. And earlier, on Monday, the House Speaker said he had not yet heard from the president about debt ceiling talks, despite the fact that the House passed a package to raise the debt ceiling by $1.5 trillion last week. The bill also includes spending cuts, beefed-up work requirements in safety net programs, and other measures that Democrats would not accept. Chuck Schumer has described the House legislation as dead on arrival in the Senate. Following the bill's passage in the House, the president told reporters he would be happy to meet with Kevin McCarthy, but not on whether or not the debt limit gets extended. The White House has maintained that the president would only accept a clean proposal to raise the nation's borrowing limit. A White House official told CNN on Monday that at the proposed meeting with congressional leaders, Biden will stress that Congress must take action to avoid default without conditions, and invited the four congressional leaders to the White House to discuss the urgency of preventing default, as well as how to initiate a separate process to address the budget and fiscal year 2024 appropriations. Reaction from Capitol Hill underscored on Monday that the partisan battle lines remain entrenched over this issue. Republican senators urged President Biden to get to the negotiating table with Kevin McCarthy, while Senate Democrats vowed they would not negotiate with Republicans on raising the debt limit. Senate Minority Whip John Thune said the news that the U.S. could default on 1st of June if Congress does not act reinforces the need for Biden to negotiate with McCarthy. Time is being wasted, the Republican from South Dakota said as he entered Mitch McConnell's office. But Hawaii Democrat Senator Brian Schatz accused Republicans of hostage-taking and said Democrats would not give in to that threat. This is not just abnormal, but reckless. To take the American economy hostage, this cannot be tolerated, Senator Schatz said. The only thing scarier than not negotiating with these people is negotiating with them, because they will never ever stop holding Americans and the American economy hostage. The national broadcaster CBS News has also covered this story. President Biden called the four congressional leaders on Monday afternoon and invited them to a 9th of May meeting on the debt ceiling, according to three people familiar with the calls. The White House later announced in a statement that the invitation had been made. This afternoon, President Biden called Speaker Kevin McCarthy to invite him to a meeting at the White House on 9th of May with congressional leaders Jeffries, Schumer, and McConnell, who the president also called today. According to a White House official in this meeting with congressional leaders, President Biden will stress that Congress must take action to avoid default without conditions. The president invited the four congressional leaders to the White House to discuss the urgency of preventing default, the official said. And at the same time, President Biden plans to raise with them how a separate process might be initiated to address the budget and appropriations for the 2024 fiscal year. The invitation comes as Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen warned the U.S. could default on its debt obligations as soon as 1st of June, less than a month away. The White House also confirmed the calls. The White House has repeatedly insisted that it's up to Congress and Republicans who control the House of Representatives to avoid default, even as the House passed a bill last week to raise the debt limit and cut spending. That bill is unlikely to pass the Senate. It's not yet clear that the invitations have been accepted by the congressional leaders or that 9th of May is a firm date. NBC News has also covered this story and tells us more. President Joe Biden has called the top four congressional leaders to a meeting on 9th of May at the White House to discuss how to avert a debt default, according to a White House official and Capitol Hill sources familiar with the matter. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen warned in a letter on Monday that the U.S. could breach the debt ceiling by 1st of June, earlier than expected, if Congress doesn't act in time. The letter sent shockwaves across Capitol Hill, with a threat of economic calamity looming as Congress and the White House remained deadlocked over the issue. There was little sign on Monday, 1st of May, that either party was shifting off its position. House Republicans insist on attaching spending cuts to a debt ceiling increase, while Democrats vow not to negotiate over whether to pay the country's bills or default. The White House official said Biden will stress to congressional leaders that they must take action to avoid default without any preconditions, saying the meeting was scheduled to discuss the urgency of preventing default as well as how to begin negotiating a budget. Democrats have insisted on a clean debt limit increase without policy conditions and for Congress to negotiate over spending cuts Republicans demanded in the separate government funding process, which has a deadline of 30th of September. That is the appropriate place to debate and discuss our nation's fiscal picture, not in a hostage situation in which extreme MAGA Republicans try to impose their radical agenda on America. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries said in a joint statement on Monday evening, "We do not have the luxury of waiting until 1st of June to come together, pass a clean bill to avoid a default and prevent catastrophic consequences for our economy and millions of American families. Republicans cannot allow right-wing extremism to hold our nation hostage," Schumer and Hakeem Jeffries wrote. President Biden also called Congress's top two Republicans, House Speaker Kevin McCarthy of California and Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, on Monday.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi.
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr.
He was born in Kazimiya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahroudi was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati,
there is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamari that he says in Farsi, "Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid."
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. We're welcome to another episode of the program, The Teacher, an introduction into the life and works of the Muslim, Shiite personalities and ulama all across the world. I am Atta, the host of this program. I have two very special guest speakers for today's discussion, Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi and Shaykh Rouhani. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Shaykh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Okay, for today's discussion, we want to talk about one of the most outstanding scholars of the 14th century Hijra, Muhammad Taghi Shirazi, also known as Mirzai Dovom or Mirzai Kuchak. He was the leader of the independence political movement of Iraq against the supremacy of Britain. We can say most of his fatawa and fatwas were issued against the Britain and the foreign powers' presence in Iraq. He was a very much committed scholar and alim, not limiting himself only to Islamic courses or the Islamic seminaries. Politically and socio-culturally, he was very much active. Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi, let's start with you, brother. Give us some details about the early life of Muhammad Taghi Shirazi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, Muhammad Taghi Shirazi was known as Mirza, second Mirza, or Mirza Kuchak, and obviously he was in Iraq. About his initial life, it is said that Mirza Muhammad Taghi Shirazi was in Karbala, and there he started his educational life. And after that, he went to Samarra, where he has taken some lessons from the great Mirza, who was famous for his tobacco.
Yes, Mirza Hassan Shirazi.
Mirza Hassan Shirazi, yes. Who was famous about his fatwa of tobacco. Over there, obviously, he lived there, and he made many students. And obviously, his life was full of, we can say, like different activities, where he was involved with the immigrants who went to the Karbala. He was also involved with the people, the different tribes, who were obviously ready for resistance. And this made his, we can say like, you know, it made him a famous and popular personality. When we talk about his students, we can see like Agha Bozorg-e Tehrani, one of the great scholars, Abdul Karim Hayri, who basically based or who founded the, who put the foundation of Hawza al-Miyaqom after Najaf. These are from his students. We have Muhammad Jawad Balaghi Najafi from his students who wrote Ala al-Rahman. And there are many, many other scholars, Muhammad Ali Shah Abadi, Ayatollah Marashi Najafi, who is known because of his library. He's buried in Qom. These are from his students. So he was at the time when obviously the England, it tried to invade the Iraq, and obviously these were the scholars of that time who resist against such invasion.
That's all right. We know that. That's all right. After the demise of Mirza Hassan Shirazi and also Akhund Khorasani, the Marja'iyat al-Am, or the general Marja'iyah, or custodianship of the Islamic seminaries, was on the shoulders of some ulama like Sheikh Sharia Isfahani, Sheikh Mahdi Khalisi, Sayyid Kazemi Yazdi, and also Muhammad Taqi Shirazi. Muhammad Taqi Shirazi, even during his marja'iyah, felt very much responsible in order to defend the borders of Islam, especially in Iraq and in Iran, against the foreign powers, the British powers and the Russian powers. Sheikh Rouhani, I think this aspect of his life might be very much interesting, especially for those who do not think that Islam or Shia Islam might be a political one, because after the Islamic Revolution of Iran take place, most of the people think that, okay, Ayatollah Khomeini was the first one who, for example, founded this system, but it has a rich legacy, isn't it?
Yes, of course. As you know, one of the main principles of Islam is jihad.
Yes.
Struggling in the way of Allah to protect and defend Muslims against the enemy's attack. So that's why, based on this principle, you see that Ayatollah Muhammad Taqi Shirazi, in 1329 of Qamari, he actually, when the Russian forces attacked the north part of Iran, he actually issued a fatwa calling upon the people to defend themselves against the Russian attack.
Yes.
It was a very famous fatwa that was issued by him in that time. And also at the beginning of the First World War, when the coalition forces started fighting in war against, waged a war against Uthmanid Empire. And so when they attacked the Uthmanid areas, then when they came to the Fao, which is a city, I think, in Iraq.
Yes.
When they actually occupied this area, Fao, I mean, in Iraq.
Yes.
Then Mirza Muhammad Taqi Shirazi, at that time he was in Samarra, he issued a fatwa and invited the tribes and Ashair of Muslimin to start fighting against British army in that area to defend their land and to actually protect their people against the Britishers. These were the two very famous fatwa which were issued by this alim or this Shiite scholar. It shows that how much political is the position or status of Marja'iyah in the Shiite ideology or in the Shiite system of thought, because you see, whenever you are attacked by, or Muslims are attacked by, the enemies, it is the responsibility of a marja'i taqlid, of the religious leader, to defend the people, to issue the fatwa. And also, he, in one of these, let's say, battlefields, he sent his own son.
Yes.
Yeah, to defend the people, and he accompanied him. So that's why supported him.
Muhammad Reza, his son.
Yes,
Muhammad
of course.
Reza Shirazi,
it shows that, yes, this is one of the main responsibilities of Marja'i Taqlid, to even wage war against the enemy's attack when it is needed. Yeah, that's it.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
founding of Jamaat al-Islamiyah or Jamiat al-Islami, Islamic Society, we can call it, okay, was one of the outstanding achievements of this outstanding man, writing letters to different leaders of Muslim lands and also United States of America in defense of the Islamic lands, okay? According to so many documents, he was very much concerned with rulership of the Muslims over Muslims and not the non-Muslims, for example, Britain. And we know that at that time, Britain, through his spies in Iran and the embassies, wanted to rule Islamic lands, especially through, for example, some economic contracts in Iran and some monopolizing, for example, some lands in Iraq. Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, in one of the most outstanding fatwas, we read that no Muslim has the right to select a non-Muslim as his ruler in the Muslim lands. This is an important fatwa of him. Let's talk a little bit about this aspect of his life.
Well, obviously, when we look at his political life, we can find this aspect in his letters which he wrote, the political letters. For example, like he wrote a letter to Sharif Hussein, who was the ruler of Hijaz at that time. And in that, he wanted him to support the society, the Islamic society, the Islamic society of the Iraq, so that because they're raising against or they're having resistance against the non-Muslims. On the other hand, he wrote letter to the Amir Faisal, who was in Syria, in Damascus. And he asked him to convey the message of Sheikh and his supporters. Why? Because the Damascus had the access to the international media and they were free. For example, if that, at that time it was radio and other source of means of the media, so they had open access to it. And he asked them, he requested them to convey our message to the world so that the world knows that the Iraqi people, they don't want the invasion of the Britons over them. Other than that, we can see like with Sheikh Sharia Isfahani, he wrote a letter to the USA, to the Americans, yes, the president of America, that all the people of Iraq, they want a new government, which should be independent, number one. Number two, an Islamic independent state. Why? Because the Muslims are living here. And number two, they want to choose someone as a king, a Muslim king who is bound to the Islamic rules and not someone who is a non-Muslim. They are not allowed to rule over the Muslims. So we can see from these letters that he was so concerned about it. And this idea that the Muslims can only rule the Muslims, this is true. Obviously, we know that even the Quranic teachings, the Islamic teachings is all about that. The reason is that when there is a ruler who is bound to the Islamic rules, Islamic laws, he, according to the Quran, must be a just person. Obviously, he look after the rituals of the Muslims. And obviously, there is no contradiction. For example, you know, we have people right now living in the West.
Yes.
Right? And they are the Muslims. They are free to, you know, observe or to practice their Islam. But the point is the environment in which they are.
Yes, yes.
That is not an Islamic environment. You know, for example, there is non-mahram. There is half-naked people. So a person who wants to observe Islam, who wants to practice Islam, where Islam says that the woman should cover herself, now there is a hurdle for this person to do that. Similarly, for the women, obviously, when they go to the work, there is a special dress code they cannot. So these are the reasons that we can see today, those who do not understand this, that what will happen if a non-Muslim ruler will rule a Muslim land? The reason is that a non-Muslim ruler will bring alcohol into the Muslim land. The non-Muslim ruler will bring the other things that contradicts with the Islamic laws. So yes, when he is not bound to them, the people, you know, we have the hadith, "An-nasu ala dini muluki." The people are upon the religion of their kings.
That's right.
When the rulership is in the hands of a non-Muslim, then obviously there is a big chance of Muslims becoming non-Muslim.
That's right. So many letters were sent from the head of the tribes because Iraq at that time was a tribal country that, for example, the British and the Russian powers are attacking them and want them to yield to the orders of the British, what should we do? And Mirza, in his outstanding fatwa, has said that defending your rights and defending your movement, defending your people and your country is, we can say, an obligation for you. And if you yield up to their needs, to their orders, you are doing a haram action. And that's why, for example, the British powers on that time and the Britain on that time could not occupy so many parts of Iraq, that land. He said that I sacrifice everything. I sacrifice my son, my companions, my comrades. I am ready to sacrifice my own life to defend Islam on that time. All in all, we could see that the Hausa was not only active in the, for example, Islamic seminaries of Najaf and Karbala and Samarra, you know. The students and the Islamic seminaries were really much active and felt responsible to, about the affairs of the community. Okay, what other details, Sheikh Rouhani, about his political life?
Yes, one of the other things that is interesting in his life is that he tried to manage or to rule over the city of Karbala. Mm-hmm. And also he appointed some people to manage the affairs of the Holy Shrine of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and to help the people of Karbala. And he himself was observing as an observer on all those things that were done by some of the people who were appointed by him in the city of Karbala. It was also one of the interesting points in his life that is also a kind of social activities of this marja-i-taqlid at that time.
That's right. We know that Karbala was freed from the hands, we can say, by the hands of the mujahids on that time, and so many outstanding ulama like Sayyid Abul Ghassam Kashani, Sayyid Hussain Qazvini, Sayyid Habaduddin Shahristani were active over there in the city of Karbala. That's right. He passed away in a mysterious way on Zilhijjah 1338. According to some documents, he was poisoned by the Britishers. It is not something far away from the thoughts because he was against the Britishers. Sheikh Sharia Isfahani did the burial pray and he was buried in the holy shrine of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. And most of the cities, most tribes in Iraq held mourning sessions and morning gatherings for the late Ayatollah Muhammad Taghi Shirazi, or Shahid Muhammad Taghi Shirazi, mainly known as Mirzai Dovom or Mirzai Kuchak. Thank you much, Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi and Sheikh Rouhani, for a nice elaboration regarding his life. It was very kind of you. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information and to download for free our previous episodes of the program The Teacher, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.